In this episode of Skeptico, well-known psychology researcher and skeptic Dr. James Alcock counters the notion that parapsychology research is ignored by academia.
You could come up with good data that showed there's something to the paranormal. Parapsychologists would be trampled by psychologists and physicists and so on, rushing to the study of it.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and we're joined today by Dr. James Alcock, professor of psychology at York University in Toronto and very highly regarded member of PSYCOP, the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal. Dr. Alcock is also the co-editor of the book Psy Wars. Some of you may recall that just recently, we interviewed Dr. Gene Burns, one of the other co-editors of the book. Welcome, Dr. Alcock. Thanks for joining us on Skeptico.
Good to be here.
Dr. Alcock, you're someone who's been identified with scientific skepticism for a long time. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to that point of view or that position? Have you always been skeptical by nature, or was there some specific event that kind of drove you in that direction?
Well, I don't know. I think, you know, you've actually touched on a very interesting question, because as a psychologist, I think it's probably much more interesting to ask how it is people come to be skeptics than how they come to be believers, because I really think that our brains and nervous systems and our culture and so forth really push us towards belief in all sorts of things that may not be true. In my own case, I guess I always thought of myself as a critical thinker more than as a skeptic. When I was young, I dreamed of being a parapsychologist, and that's what I wanted to grow up to be. So I certainly had an interest in the paranormal. When I actually did an undergraduate degree in physics, was accepted into graduate school in physics, but then changed my mind, decided that I wanted to do something different, and ended up in psychology. And it was in psychology that I really learned how to evaluate research with human subjects very carefully. And it was after some years of study that I was asked to have a look at the literature in the paranormal, and I remembered my childhood interest and expected to find something that would be intriguing, but I quickly became disillusioned by the quality of the vast majority of the research that I saw. And so my skepticism grew out of critical thinking about the literature, about the difficulty of studying this subject matter. And it seemed to me that if there is something there, one needs to bring the finest research instruments to it. So over the following years, I kept trying to find some examples of research that was good enough that it would persuade me there was something there. And eventually I became persuaded that it's much more likely that there's nothing there, that in fact the various studies I've seen over the years, if you take them all together, in my mind, are better explained in terms of simply problems with the research.
Right. So it kind of grew organically. And actually, you kind of touched on, I think, your very excellent essay, Give the Null Hypothesis a Chance. And for any of you listening who maybe aren't familiar with Dr. Alcock's book, Psy Wars, you may want to check out the essay that you can actually find a link to and read for free on the internet if you don't want to fork over the money for the book. But it's I think it's required reading for anyone interested in this field on one side or the other. I was really struck with the way you basically kind of laid out the case for Psy, and I think you came to the conclusion that there's still some reasons to be very skeptical of the claims, in your opinion. Those are claims of telepathy or PK or precognition or survival of consciousness after death. Is that basically correct?
That's right. In fact, the problem is that the subject matter by itself is, of course, a difficult one to study. But nonetheless, the subject matter of modern physics is very difficult to study. And yet modern physics and other areas of conventional science make progress by finding you know, refined instruments that improve the quality of the results and so forth. So you don't have to go that back that many years when very few astrophysicists believed that there are black holes. It was a theoretical notion. Now I think virtually every astrophysicist believes there are black holes because people have found ways to test those notions, and they've accumulated data, and they've used instruments that measure incredibly small amounts of energy and so forth. The problem in parapsychology is that there really has been no growth across a century, that the in quote scientific basis quote for belief in parapsychology is as weak now as it was when people first brought a scientific attitude towards trying to study it, and that's a big difficulty, because in fact you'd expect that no matter what one says about there not being enough research funds and so forth, one would expect that over this length of time there would be at least some phenomenon that was indisputable, some phenomenon, however weak, that could be reproduced by skeptical, by neutral scientists, but that's never occurred. And you look at what were the great studies of the 1920s, by the 1930s they were forgotten, parapsychologists weren't defending them. By the 1930s there were a new group of studies, in modern times no one gives those much importance. And so it is. 50s, 60s to 70s, you find all these apparent breakthroughs in methodology. A decade later, you find they've been abandoned because people have discovered flaws in the way the research was done. This is no longer good evidence. And so that provides a very poor basis for belief that there really is a phenomenon. The other thing I'd like to say, Alex, and I mentioned this in my essay at the beginning of the book, parapsychology is rather unique in that in other areas where people try to study something scientifically, the phenomenon is defined in a positive sense, whereas with parapsychology, the definition is inherently negative. Extrasensory perception exists, the definition of it is, only when there appears to be communication, when you've ruled out all possible normal sources. Well, of course, you can't always be sure, in fact I suppose one could say one can never be absolutely sure that you've ruled out normal sources. And so when you go through the history of parapsychology, you find many things which at the time were defined as evidence of the paranormal because all possible sources were ruled out. 5, 10, 15 years later, people look back over the data and they find in fact explanations which normal explanations which can't be ruled out. So that makes the subject matter inherently very difficult, and all the more reason to take great care in studying it. Now, one of the problems that bothers me about some people in parapsychology is that they argue that, well, because this is, quote, such an elusive phenomenon, what we should do is loosen the rules of science. And I would argue just the opposite. Since this is a negatively defined phenomenon with very little to really even support the claim, that we need to be particularly careful, because it's so easy to fool ourselves and to be deluded when we're looking for something that we hope exists. In some cases, parapsychologists are convinced it exists, but for which there's only the most shaky evidence.
You know, those are really good points, and you really lay them out well in the article and in the book. But there's still some things that bother me. And I think one of the biggest problems I have it is what you call the a priori or what you might call the paradigm. But to me, a lay person who's just kind of wandered into this field, I call it the wonder and awe factor. You know, you have one position, that of scientific skepticism, that says, okay, we've pretty much figured out what's going on here, and you're proposing something that's kind of way out of line with that. And if you have anything really good, we'll take a look at it, but you haven't produced anything in the past. And you have this other side that says, now, wait a minute. You know, your materialistic explanation for things completely misses an enormous part of the human experience. Tell me I have no consciousness, no free will, no cell, no soul, that the love that I feel for my family and friends is this electrochemical reaction. And I'll tell you scientifically, you know, you've missed the wonder and awe of life. And somewhere in there, you know, maybe I haven't approached it right from a scientific standpoint, but your paradigm isn't working for me either.
Okay, let me respond to that, because I think in a sense it's confusing two things. I don't think a neurologist sits and looks at her family or his family and thinks, oh, this part of my brain is firing right now. A neurologist feels as much love as any of us do. A careful, critical, materialistic scientist in the laboratory, surely, and the vast majority of them, are as capable of love, of being inspired by a poem or a beautiful flower, of enjoying life to the fullest. And so there's a big difference. I mean, the thing is, for example, you don't think about the function of your kidneys during the day or whether your pancreas is secreting unless there are problems with them. Right? That you take them for granted. You shouldn't be worrying about how your body functions. You shouldn't be worrying about how your brain functions. So in terms of the joy and the beauty of life, absolutely agree. You know, forget about all this stuff. It's not relevant. But if you've got a brain tumor, you better hope that there were a lot of people who tried to understand how it is that the cells in your brain worked. And similarly, when it comes to the paranormal, I have no problem if people want to believe in ESP. It doesn't bother me one bit. I've got drawn into this always because people want to go more than into the belief of it. What some people want to do is to say, although we decry your scientific skepticism, we want to prove to you on scientific grounds that we are right. And all I'm saying, if people are happy to say we believe this and we don't care what science is, fine. If people say we have scientific evidence for this, and as with any other scientific claim, they have to duke it out. I mean, you can't try to draw from the reputation, the credibility of science, and yet say, please treat us differently. And I'll tell you one thing: regular science, regular psychology. I'll tell you the severity of my critique of regular normal psychology experiments is every bit as tough and probably tougher than it is of parapsychologists. Right? So it's. I mean, I have no problem, for example, if a priest, Catholic priest, says, you know, I'm going to bless the bread and the wine, and it turns literally into the blood and you know, the body and the blood of Christ. If the priest or if Catholic practitioners believe that, I don't care. But if the Catholic Church suddenly said, listen, we have scientific evidence. We've examined this wine blessed by the priest, and it's got blood platelets in it. Hemoglobin, right? Well. Then, if they're saying we have scientifically demonstrated this, should science say, "Oh, okay, that's good science," or should science say, "Well, if you're going to use the name of science, then let's see if you've used the criteria that mainstream science uses." That's all I'm saying.
Fair enough.
Right. So you can't have it both ways, right?
Yeah. There's a point there, but. Don't you think that sometimes skeptics are guilty of kind of throwing around this term science like it's some kind of monolith of truth? And of course it's not. I mean, there's controversy in every area of science. You know, I just ran across this study the other day that showed that, you know, drug research done at major universities are three times more likely to show efficacy of the drug if the drug company has sponsored the work.
Oh, sure.
Let me just make another point, because I'd love to hear your response to this, and it's getting closer to some of the things that you've worked on in belief. But I take, for example, the whole mind-body medicine thing. You know, scientific skeptics, and I don't think you are part of this whole movement, but they fought that every step of the way for 20 years. Now, you know, mind-body medicine is mainstream, and the old paradigm is giving way to evidence-based medicine and this evidence-based psychology, right? If it works, use it, or at least closer to that. And I just wonder if a similar paradigm is applied to psi, do some things start to look different? I mean, near-death experiences, look at it from a psychological standpoint. Are near-death experiences transformative? Are life afterlife encounters transformative? I don't know how it would look if we took that angle of it.
Well, look, here's the point. You made a number of good points, Alex. One is that science is carried out by human beings. Human beings are biased, prejudiced, sometimes bigoted. Human beings make mistakes. The neat thing about science is, however, it's filled with people with competing ideas, and sooner or later, sometimes it takes a long time, sometimes a short time, because you have this battle of ideas, which is tied ultimately to show us the data, the misinformed, the wrong-headed notions get tossed out, right? But it's not it's not tossed out because someone keeps saying, I believe. It's tossed out because, finally, the old theories, the old explanations don't work as well as some new explanations. Now, I've looked at probably as much parapsychological literature, certainly as any quote skeptic, and probably more than most parapsychologists. And I've gone through it. I've actually developed friendships amongst some parapsychologists. And in fact, what's interesting is that what I would consider leading parapsychologists, although they strongly believe there's something they're pursuing, some of them agree with me that as yet there has been no definitive evidence. So that's what we've got to be careful of here. What is the evidence? And if someone has evidence that can't be explained, then if scientists don't look at it, then they're guilty of bullheadedness. If, on the other hand, people say, here is our evidence, and scientists say, as we would say in any other area of science, okay, let's see if we can repeat it. And if you can't repeat it, and if people say to you, well, you can't get the results because you're skeptical, well, then you say, well, that's kind of unusual in science, but let's try to find a neutral person who can repeat it. And if you look through the literature, what you find over and over again is this inability by people, neutral or skeptical, well, let's stick with neutral, to define the same phenomena. You know, it's not the case. It's absolutely wrong to say that psychology itself or that science itself, formal science, has not looked at parapsychology. If you go back over the past century, and I wrote about this in an article in Brain and Behavior Sciences, it turns out that in the 1940s, over majority of experimental psychologists believed there was something to this business that needed research. Many, many, many people in the American Association for the Advancement of Science believed it needed study. There were roundtables held by the American Psychological Association a number of times. The American Physical Society invited parapsychologists to bring their data. In fact, in the early days of parapsychology in North America, the American Association for Psychical Research, which later became more of a spiritualist organization, originally had on it a number of prominent scientists and psychologists who looked at the data. Unfortunately, what's happened in every one of these situations is these people who came with some enthusiasm because they thought they now finally had some data that might be persuasive, soon dropped out because they could not repeat the effects. They saw that the whenever you tightened up the controls, the phenomena disappeared. And then it became really a matter of belief, not a science. And if you look in parapsychological literature, you'll see this over and over and over again, that this notion keeps cropping up that, well, if the controls are too tight, it destroys the ability of the recipients to receive the messages, etc. Well, that may be true, you know, it may also be true that, people are getting messages from a spiritual being. That if it's something that one can't study scientifically, then one can't claim to have scientific evidence. If one claims it can be scientifically studied, then one has to follow, it's not some arbitrary set of rules, but some basic notions of how it is we evaluate data. And that one of the most important things is that it's not simply something that's simply perceivable by one person or a small group of people who share the same beliefs.
I'm hearing you. Give the null hypothesis a chance. That's a great title. I think that's a classic. Let me shift the discussion just a little bit and see if we can kind of bring it back in, because I think it relates to paradigm. You know, as a professor of psychology and someone who's actually, from reading your bio, has practiced as a clinical psychologist and spent a good time thinking and writing about beliefs, I'd like to talk about Freud. And I have a lot of respect for the field of psychology, and I better say that because my wife's a psychologist and she
right.
But you know, I was stunned just to kind of learn that basically a lot of the scholars that have looked into Sigmund Freud in the last 20 years have kind of totally revealed, scholars like Frederick Cruz have kind of put it that he's a complete charlatan, fabricated case studies in order to promote himself and these radical theories. And my question is to the issue of that you were just really talking about. And I think it was very sensible what you said. You know, you have to show us the data.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The other part of that is what I'm trying to kind of get you to maybe explain from your experiences, that data does fit into a larger paradigm. And how do these paradigms become established, and then how do they become overthrown? I mean, I think Freud is a classic example of that, of the paradigm that was very established and still has eroded somewhat, but still holds a lot of weight.
Well, except that I would never consider Freud to have been a scientist. He in no way followed the rules of science. He made no systematic study of data. He produced this whole generalized theory of everything from child development to war based on his clinical experiences with some Viennese women. He never studied children directly. He wrote about children, but he never actually did more than meet them once or twice, and then he'd communicate with their parents. So he was, if anything, the arch example of someone who was carried away on the wings of his belief. It was not science. Now, but when we talk about paradigms in the scientific sense, we can look at, for example, the shift from Newton to Einstein. And a lot of people, some of them speaking on behalf of parapsychology, use this shift as an example. They say, well, look at, you know, before Einstein, you know, people had no conception of relativity, etc. Yes, but what's really, there are two things that are really important about that shift and other shifts in science. One is that Newtonian physics is not wrong. It's simply limited. But to what it applies now as much as it did before Einstein. The second thing is the shift to Einsteinian thought came about not because people outside the world of physics were saying, we've got something you scientists should look at. It came from within science. And in fact, all paradigm shifts within science, scientific paradigm shifts have come within science when, in fact, the data that have accumulated gradually have got to the point where the existing paradigm, the existing theories, just don't do a good job of explaining them. And so then that pushes people to think about new ways of looking at them. These are often very controversial. Einsteinian physics was very controversial at first. But eventually explains the data better than anything else. And so people finally say, well, that has to be what we accept. And, you know, you look at modern quantum mechanics, I find the, and relativity, and as I mentioned, I did my undergraduate honors degree in physics, I find the absolutely accepted worldwide beliefs associated with the theory of relativity and with quantum mechanics to be much more bizarre, much more incredible than anything in parapsychology. And yet, bizarre as those things are, there's abundant physical evidence. I mean, quantum mechanics has been demonstrated, it's probably had more repeated precise demonstrations than anything else in the history of science. So we have that on the one hand with its crazy predictions and with notions that people 100 years ago would have found fantastical, unbelievable, and now it's at the core of science. So I just don't believe, you know, I tell you, Alex, I honestly believe this. I believe that if one could come up with good data that showed there's something to the paranormal, and I know that Sony Labs for a while apparently was studying this, and all kinds of people have given it some study, if you could find parapsychologists would be trampled by psychologists and physicists and so on rushing to the study of it, because you'd have a whole cohort of young psychologists who are going to become famous because they're the first ones to really get, you know, I know I'm sort of rambling here, but pull me back to base if I'm too far out of
no,
orbit,
not at
but,
all.
But, you know, Röntgen, when he discovered X-rays, within 18 months, he'd listed something like 40 properties of X-rays, something no one ever heard of before, something totally mysterious. And guess what? Those properties he found were replicable by everyone. On the other hand, in that same era, Mr. Blanlot at the University of Nancy in France discovered N-rays, named after his university, Nancy. And these were rays that were emitted by everything except wood, it turned out. And people in his lab, he saw these, other people saw them, and it was seemed like quite a breakthrough, except it didn't fit with conventional theory, but he was a very prominent physicist. And so other physicists naturally got very interested in this, and a physicist, American physicist, named Robert Wood, was sent, I believe, by the British Royal Society to look at his lab. And Blondlow believed that some particular crystal in his apparatus was absolutely crucial to these rays being produced, and so Wood took it out when he wasn't looking, and Blondlow saw the rays anyway. And it turns out everybody now knows this was simply misperception. I always thought it was ironic that the one thing that wouldn't emit these rays apparently was Wood, and a physicist by the name of Wood was the one who I think this, what this does for me is there's an important message, and that is, even the best of scientists can become seduced by his own theories. And so Röntgen was right, and other people could replicate it. Blondlow was wrong. Only those people around him who shared a belief could replicate it. Soon it became clear that there were no N-rays. So when we look at the paranormal, I mean, there are lots of object lessons there. If in fact people can obtain information without using the mechanisms and physical brain, it shouldn't be that difficult to observe. And so when we see all these studies that are done, if they are what they claim to be, and in my opinion, the ones I've looked at, most of them have some serious flaws. But even that being said, the most important thing is, you know, if you correct it, can you repeat it? And that's the problem. Replicability, in fact, was described as one parapsychologist as being perhaps the most central feature of parapsychology. And again, it's led some parapsychologists to say, well, you know, so what's the big deal with replicability? We're dealing here with different phenomena than normal science. Well, then if these aren't subject to the normal methods of science, then let's not pretend that we're studying them scientifically.
I really have to agree with you completely on that. You know, and that kind of leads into the next thing. And I was really going to ask your advice. I mean, recently I've become involved in a couple of projects and funding those projects to try and replicate a couple of paranormal experiments, one with Dr. Rupert Sheldrick from King's College, Cambridge, involving
right.
telephone telepathy. Really, I think it doesn't require much money, but I want to be careful in the way that we go about doing that, and I want to make sure that we involve the right people to make sure that it's done correctly. And the other is with Gary Schwartz, who I'm sure you're familiar with, at the University
right.
of Arizona, and who's using mm-hmm. mediums
yes.
to explore survival of consciousness after death. First off, can I just ask, in general, what is your opinion of those two areas of research that have been going on for a while?
Well, you know, I met Dr. Sheldrake last year, and he's a most charming gentleman. He is a very, very decent human being. And when we chatted, this is at a conference, we've had some limited correspondence since, but when we chatted, I said to him, you know, we totally disagree on the significance of your data, but let's keep, you know, let's keep that, you know, there's no reason for us not to be as warm towards each other as if we were two golfers in a golf course, right? But I happen to believe, from looking at Dr. Sheldrake's data, that his conclusions are not justified based on the data that he has. I see flaws in the data. He doesn't really agree that these are flaws. But I think if one were I think it's a good idea to try to replicate what he's doing. One of the things, though, that's interesting, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with the staring experiments. Some of the early parapsychologists back in the 20s did staring experiments, and they came to the conclusion that there was nothing there. And this was then abandoned by modern parapsychology. No modern parapsychologist that I know of, apart from Dr. Sheldrake, has had much interest or any interest in this. So he's brought it to the fore again. So my concern, if you go to replicate it, is simply this. It is there's a phenomenon there only if you can eliminate all conventional explanations. And that is often difficult to do. And that takes a great deal of care.
Well, Dr. Alcock, let me probe that a minute, because this could really be helpful. And I would love to have you further involved in this in terms of get your comment on things that we're going to make. One of the goals in this research project is a concept that we're kind of calling open source science. And the idea is to make everything from the initial research goals to the experimental protocols all open and available from the beginning to kind of public debate. And even though the results aren't targeted at a peer-reviewed journal, they're targeted at to be open to the whole process so that everyone feels that they've gotten a fair shake. So the experiment that we've tentatively planned on replicating is email telepathy. So there's someone who's a receiver of an email, and there's five prospective close friends who are going to send that email, and it's the experience of, oh, I was just thinking of you, and here you sent me an email, and that the results would be greater than you would statistically expect. And I would just point out, because here it gets down to the nuts and bolts of like a real research problem. One of the problems that Dr. Sheldrick has had in replicating this experiment is setting it up in a way that satisfies both skeptics and is workable. For example, if you require all the senders, that is all the people that might send the receiver the email, to be in the same room at the same location and videotaped at the same time, it's very hard. These people might be spread across the world. They have jobs to do and all that. Versus if you say, okay, the receiver, we're going to be very careful. We're going to watch them, make sure they're not getting any other signals. We're going to videotape them. But the senders, we're going to kind of let them be everywhere. That to me, again, just a layperson kind of digging into this, I would say, gee, that would seem a reasonable control. And I'm just in discussion, the spirit of just kind of discussing something. As a scientist who's looked at experiments, what kind of controls would you look for in an experiment like that? What would be red flags that would say, hey, there's something seriously flawed in the...
Well, you know, I'm probably not going to give you a satisfying answer, because unless I could actually see an actual research protocol and had a week or so to reflect on it, I probably couldn't come up with the things that would concern me. One of the things to remember is that, of course, what is happening in such an experiment, because there is no positive definition of telepathy, all one is doing is saying, okay, we think by chance this should happen, and now let's look statistically to see whether it happens more than one would expect by chance. So when you get into the statistical model, then there are a whole number of problems that can come up. One is the statistical model appropriate? And the problem there is that since you're using statistics in a particular situation, sometimes in advance you can't think of all the problems that might present themselves. Let me give you an example. When the remote viewing studies were done in California at the SRI a number of years ago, they had a bunch of targets, pictures of targets. These were all randomly selected. That they spent a great deal of time making sure the targets were properly chosen. They would pick one at random in a given day, and they would take the subject out to that site. It would be a geographical location. The receiver would sit in the room and try to intuit, try to receive telepathic messages or clairvoyant messages as to what was going on. And now the problem came in not at that point, but it came in because it was not the receiver who decided whether or not he was successful. It was some judges later on. And there were a series of about 10 trials. And so they worked out a statistical model. The judges rated each response for each target and said, okay, let's rank these things. Turns out the statistics were all done appropriately. The procedure itself was almost appropriate. And there was one thing that the experimenters had not appreciated was a problem. It was not written up in their articles. And it only came to light years later when some psychologists from New Zealand managed to get a hold of the original records.
Right. It was the sequence of the targets, right?
That's right. So they were getting feedback where one would say, well, you did pretty well yesterday. And it turned out that with these cues in there, the judges, without really being aware of it, could actually get information about the sequence of targets and the sequence of responses. And that's where the bias came in. If you took out those cues, the effect disappeared. I'm only using that as an example of how, if you were to do this study, even if I or some other people could help you and say, wow, this is as watertight as we can get it, from my point of view, forget for a moment this is parapsychology. Let's just talk about any sort of normal scientific approach. What one should do is you make the procedure as watertight as you can. You run the study. Now, let's suppose you get significant results. Rather than saying, aha, we've proven psi here, instead it's better to say, okay, now let's figure out what might have gone on. What now if we took some subjects, some email senders, and kept them all in the same room? Would that make any difference? Or what would happen if we did this? So rather than accepting that something called psi has occurred, one says, let's vary some of the circumstances and see if it makes a difference. So that we find out whether there's something else going on other than this vague sense of psi. So I guess what I'm saying is one should never set up a single study and say, oh God, this will make it perfect and this will be the test. But of course, if you make it as perfect as possible, that increases your motivation for doing more, because obviously you seem to be onto something. Now, you know, Robert John's lab has just closed down, or just closing down at Princeton, I heard the other day. But he, a physicist here at my university who approached me years ago, he had been in contact with John. He was quite impressed by what John had done. He wanted to work with John to do conceptual replication. And he approached me and he said, I didn't know him, although he's my university. He said, look, I want to talk to you about this. I'm going to show you some research protocols. I want your criticisms in advance. I don't want them after the fact. I said, fair enough. I will look at your procedure. And I had been critical of John's procedures, and he had never instituted any of the changes I thought he should make. But this particular physicist did. And in fact, he ran a number of studies and was never able to find anything. John was very supportive at first. Finally, the fact that he found nothing, you know, fell on the cutting room floor. No one talks about it anymore because it's considered unimportant. Had he found something, it would be considered very important. But again, what was important was trying to get it right at the beginning, and then whether it turns out right or wrong, having some idea in mind, okay, whatever the results are, what would be the next step that would help us make sure we're not being deceived by what we get here? Am I being too obtuse too vague?
No, not at all. I think that's very, very, very and very illustrative of exactly the kind of situation that I think you can run into. How about Dr. Gary Schwartz at the University of Arizona and the survival of consciousness with the mediums thing? What do you think of that?
Well, to be fair, I haven't spent a lot of time on, I've looked at some of his work. I haven't looked at a lot of it. Frankly, I haven't been impressed by the quality of the research. Again, I think if one wanted to study what he's doing, you can do anything well, right? I mean, if you, no matter what you want to study, you can study the existence of Santa Claus in a silly way, or you can study it, very carefully. So anybody who wants to try to repeat what Dr. Schwartz has done, I would advise them to think very carefully about the methodology, and be prepared always to accept that there may be nothing there, right? That's the null hypothesis.
Absolutely
again.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Is there anything else that we might cover that we haven't kind of chatted about?
Well, I guess just one point I'd like to make, and you know, parapsychologists often think that I'm this closed-minded bigot when it comes to their subject matter. I'm just as critical as people who go around in a knee-jerk way being skeptical about stuff and ruling it, you know, saying, and they haven't even read the literature, right? I think that sometimes, when I speak to skeptics groups, not all skeptics by any means, but certainly some of them have the same bias in the other direction. And I guess all I would like to promote for everybody is the approach to questions, if one wants to study them scientifically, the approach that one is going to bring the best methodology to bear that one could possibly come up with, and that one is going to try to bend over backwards to think of ways that you could be fooled, to think of ways that you might be mistaken, because the bane of every researcher is to be to be captivated by some notion, and then, like Dr. Blondlow, go out and find it, even if it's not there. So I think that what we need to do as human beings, whether one is a proponent or one's a skeptic, is to recognize that we have competing beliefs. Some beliefs can be tested by this method called science that we've evolved over the centuries. Some beliefs can't. So if you happen to be Hindu and someone else is a Zoroastrian and someone else is a Christian, there's no point in bringing science to the discussion of, you know, which God is which, right? And science can't do anything there. So you may as well simply either discuss it on a philosophical level or stick to your own theology. But if it comes to things where, in fact, we should, if these things exist, be able to demonstrate them, then I think what we should try to do is to focus always on the methodology. One philosopher once wrote a methodological skepticism, and I like that term because I'm skeptical. I bring that skepticism to methodology, whether I'm looking at mainstream psychology or parapsychology, and it's the only way that we're ever going to. I mean, to me, science is first and foremost really a way of trying collectively to avoid self-deception. Right, and science, you know, even with the best science, we do get fooled. We scientists are often wrong for a period of time, but gradually, because they stick with this method, gradually we get so that we have polio vaccines and we have rockets to go to the moon and so on. Whereas if we look at areas that might be called pseudoscience, there's no growth. There's nothing that changes over the decades.
Very good. Well, you've just introduced another great term, methodological skepticism. So thank you again for a very thoughtful discussion. I look forward to inviting your participation in these replications by, we'll send you an email and see if you have any input. But thanks again for the time.
Well, you're very welcome. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Alex.
I want to thank Dr. Alcock again for joining us today on Skeptico. If you'd like to read the article, Give the Null Hypothesis a Chance, you'll find a link to it on the Skeptico website. That's skeptiko.com, where you can also check out our previous shows, download them for free, and drop me a note, send me an email, or leave me a voicemail message. Tell me how you like the show. Well, that's going to do it for today. Bye for now.